I know it is madness to keep this journal, but it gives me a strange thrill to do so.
And one day, that little journal, if you water it enough, could grow up to become a compelling memoir. Hey, welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Hope you had a great weekend. Lots to talk about in our free-flow pop culture convo. Everything from Paul Simon being arrested in Connecticut. Ooh, what's that about? George Clooney, maybe he's engaged, maybe not. We'll talk. And, of course, Sean Hannity has the Cliven Bundy Blues, not to mention a whole bunch of basketball fans are up in arms over that guy at the L.A. Clippers. We will talk all about that. And if you're listening live on Monday, April 28th, you can join us. Our number in motion, 347-857-4505. It's a 24/7 proposition these days at Twitter, at AB Writes. The show today being brought to you in part by Area Las Vegas Resort and Casino. That's how we Vegas. And by Audi, Truth in Engineering. If you're in a creative ditch, by the way, we're going to help jolt you out. Our Inspiration to Action Challenge success stories are pouring in, too. First, though, pleasure to welcome our guest to the show. Really delighted to welcome Tony Quantro, the noted musical performer and cabaret star and philanthropist who has recounted his remarkable life in this really beautiful memoir. It is told with such humor and compassion and depth. It's called Ethel Merman, Mother Teresa and Me. Can't recommend it highly enough. So happy to welcome Tony to the show. I'm hoping we got over our little telephone glitch. Hey there, Tony. How are you?
I hope we did. Did we? Can you hear me?
It sounds like it. It sounds good. Yeah, thank
good.
You. I'm so happy to have you here. First of all, before we get into the book, congratulations on a job well done. It is such a compelling story. It really is.
Oh, well, that is really kind of you. I appreciate that. I never can get tired of hearing it.
Well, you deserve it because it is told so well, and I really didn't know what to expect, frankly, when I read it, but it was just so captivating. You have so much juicy material, so it's certainly a great book. I mean, what made you decide to do it? Was it just something you were compelled to write and you knew you'd have to do it eventually, or something pushed you towards writing it at this point?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. You know, I worked for 12 years with Mother Teresa, and every day after work I would speak into a tape recorder for a half an hour. Then when she died, I listened to 40 hours of tape, and I thought, something has to be done with this. And then after I had done that, somebody said, but you know, people have to know your life, who you are. You have to put that in there. And so, you know, I put my life in there completely. But, you know, it was a process. It was a process, and I'm so glad because I was able to get out. You know, I came from a privileged and affluent childhood, Amy Beth, and it was but filled with great traumas, and you know, not easy. Even though it was affluent, people think you have an easy life. Well, it doesn't happen that way. And
well, you do recount it. You're very honest about all these things. I mean, you have your family background. You're part of the heir to the Quantro Liqueur family. You also have, from your mother's side of the family, some showbiz roots there in Boston. And just a fascinating family life. And you do tell it. It's sort of this novelistic approach. For those of us who are writers and readers, I think we'll appreciate how you get into it in such a great way. But you're very honest about your family. As you said, there's a lot of affluence there and privilege. And you love your parents, and I think you talk about them in a very loving way and a forgiving way, but you're also pretty honest about they were pretty remote when you were a child, and you had a nursemaid that really was your de facto mother for a while. Whether she was a great figure or not, it comes out in the story, won't give everything away. But your mom was kind of at arm's length, and you had to be, I think you said, mom loves us, mother loves us when we're perfect. Tell us a little more about that.
Yes. Well, mother only loves you when you're perfect. You know, we were brought in, we were dressed up, cleaned up, bathed, you know, dressed up and every hair in place and brought into mother every day for a half an hour around 5:30, 6 o'clock when she was sitting at her dressing table getting ready to go out for whatever they had for the evening. We had a half an hour with her. And I never doubted that she loved us because a child, you can't fool them. You can feel that. But she was born in 1900 and didn't have us at a young age, and she was from another era, and that's the way it was done. But the nurse was the one who did everything for us, but then she also is the one who set me up with the pedophile school teacher, which letting that out, it's amazing how many young people I have helped – when I go and I do talks or something like that, or they read the book, and then they want to speak to me because they have kept it hidden. I kept it hidden for 40 years, 40 years, and letting it out was very healthy for me, but also for so many young people who have kept it, you know, as a secret, and they feel so much better to have someone they can talk to about it. And if I can just help one person with that, the book will have been worthwhile, everything. But it was the three other mothers who healed this child. You know, the three other women, Mother Teresa, Ethel Merman, the great Dar on Broadway, and Lee Lehman, who was the wife of Bobby Lehman, the head of Lehman Brothers. And these women over the years just loved me unconditionally. And that
key.
Unconditional love is very healing.
It's so healing. And, of course, you have gone on with your own work, and you work with Mother Teresa, and we'll talk a little bit about that, to use all that unconditional love that was given to you. It came out again. Sort of was an outpouring from you to so many people who needed it, who were like forgotten people. You helped a lot of AIDS patients and a lot of.
Oh yes. Well yes, I went into the work with her when the AIDS crisis began, and no one knew how it was transmitted,
yeah.
Which was, my own doctor said, "Don't go there. It's too dangerous." And I said, "Well, if we can't do this for each other as human beings, there's no hope." But nobody wanted them. The prisons didn't want them. The hospitals didn't want them. They were all frightened. No one wanted them. Their families didn't want them. And there were young people. There were young men in their early 20s for the most part. And we gave them, again, unconditional love. We gave them a place where they could die in peace and unconditional love. And it was so healing to them to end their lives like that.
You tell it with such poignancy, and it's so moving, and there's some humor in it too. It's not just all dour. There's a lot of humor and loving passages. But it's interesting the transformation you made. I mean, you were, as you said, you had an affluent childhood. You then became part of the social world, the heyday of the gossip columns. You were in the 50s and 60s, spotted with one socialite or another, much to maybe their dismay, your dismay, and your parents' dismay for sure. And you became a cabaret performer.
You've done your homework, let me tell you.
I read the book. The homework
is
in the book.
You've done your homework, and I do admire that.
Well, it was a great book. It really is. I do recommend it to folks because I'm a writer, too, and I also work with writers as a teacher and a coach, and I encourage people when they're telling their own story, and this is memoir, to get in touch with your authentic voice and just let it out. I think there was one, I read a quote from you where somebody said, "Did you write it yourself or did you have a ghostwriter?" And you said, "Who the heck else could?" Well, more colorful language than that, but who else could write it?
Actually, I said I wrote every friggin' word. Who else could have done it?
Yeah. And it shows. It shows because it really is an authentic voice. But how people will be surprised to know how you got from, I mean, you have the other mothers, but how did you get from, okay, we can see Lee Lehman, you met her on the social circuit. Ethel Merman, you met Ethel Merman through her daughter because you took an acting class with little Ethel. And then how did you tell people how you got involved with Mother Teresa? You were just attracted to her story. You read an article about it. How did that happen for you?
I had seen when she won the Nobel Peace Prize, she became world famous. And I just called up one day. I was in New York because I was working in Europe. I was all over the world. I was singing, and I was in New York. And I just called them up because she had opened this home for AIDS, destitute men dying of AIDS. And I said, "You want to volunteer?" Well, oh boy, did they want to volunteer. And it was a small house, really, only room for 14 men. So it was like a family. And I just went down there, and 3 days later, I started working. And I was mopping floors and changing diapers on 200-pound convicts and washing three flights of stairs on my hands and knees. I mean, these are things that my friends would have killed to have a picture of. No, they couldn't believe it. but I learned. I was a little bit clumsy at first at some of these things, but you learn very fast. and, of course, the men. I was able to, you know, I pass on that unconditional love. And then, of course, Mother was there all the time, Mother Teresa. I didn't know that. This was her new baby. And so that's how we met, and we immediately, you see, we immediately connected. It was like we had known each other in another life or something. It was the same thing with Lee Lehman, with Ethel Merman. And, you know, it continued. It's not like one started and then ended. Because they continued throughout their lives. You know, 52 years after I met Lee Lehman, she died in my arms. I was there for Ethel Merman at the end of her life. Mother Teresa, I went to Calcutta to be with her when we knew she was not going to be with us much longer. So it just continued, you know, throughout the years. And what was beautiful, Amy Beth, is that I was able to give them back the unconditional love that they had shown me and healed me. And it's the most powerful force in the world.
It really is, yes. And it's true, you have these very profound connections with people, and I know you have spiritual snatches throughout the book where you talk about how people just come to you and you know that you're meant to be with them and that kind of thing, which is so interesting. But, you know, what people would find fascinating and maybe shocking, people who don't know you and are just starting to read the book, how did you make these transitions to this really very the hard work that you did in the AIDS house with these people? I mean, to just get to do that and to come, and you were someone who, you said you were very squeamish about blood and all these things, and you really overcame that. What drew you, though? I mean, I guess that's the question. What drew you to it where you felt like you're just compelled to do it and you just have to do it because it was a really big leap from your other part of your life?
Well, that's an interesting question, Amy Beth. You know, when Mother won the Nobel Peace Prize, I saw a picture, I think it was in Time magazine, but it was not of Mother. It was of a volunteer in Calcutta in the Home for the Dying carrying a dying man in his arms. And I saw that picture and something just snapped within me and I thought, I have to do this. And it was a calling. I say it was a calling, that it was something I had to do for some reason. It was a calling. Can't call it anything else. I didn't have a religious calling, but I had a calling to do this kind of work. And of course, in Calcutta, you cannot imagine. You know, it's hard to imagine the horrors that one sees there. But
yeah, you described that. We made your first trip. You really couldn't take it. And you had to come home, and then you went back.
Then I went back. That was after I had worked in the AIDS home for a while. So I was on pretty intimate terms with death and things. In Calcutta, I worked with the handicapped children, with the orphans, with the lepers, mentally challenged, everybody. And it was all so marvelous. And then every day I would sit, because Mother and I we created a bond. Mother and I and my partner of 48 years, Jim Russo. And Mother didn't care at all about that. I mean, she just loved us both, as did all three mothers, which is, you know, quite something. Mother Teresa was asked hundreds of times, Mother, what do you think of homosexuality? And she hundreds of times answered, I judge no one. And she loved him, and we would sit on her little terrace in Calcutta after work and talk for hours. And even her nuns didn't understand, you know, and
yeah,
asked us one day,
talk about, right?
Wait, what on earth do you all talk about every day? And I said, everything and nothing.
know,
there was no answer. And, she was a human being.
Yes, you brought that out. You did bring that out. And I think at one point you said you wish you had known her before she became Mother Teresa and the sacrifice that she made as a young Albanian girl to get there. I mean, it's just fascinating. It's interesting to me that you are obviously a person of great depth. You have connected with people, and I think what separates you maybe from some other people is that when something comes to you, as you said, you feel it's a calling or you have a great intuition, you kind of go with it. Some people let things go. I think we all have psychic moments where we just will let things go and dismiss them, but you're pretty attuned to that, and I guess you always have been. Well, you always
like
that as a
child. You're right. You know, my aunt Tata, whom I adored and you read about in the book, She always, I heard her my whole life say, oh, I'd love to go work with a foundling hospital here in New York. She never did. And I thought, how, what a shame, how much it would have brought to her life if she had ever followed that instinct of hers. But I love, but as far as, you know, all these women loving Jimmy, Ethel Merman, who is one of a kind, they all were, but I once said to her, I said, Ethel, I think you love Jimmy better than you love me. And she roared with laughter and said, well, maybe I do. So she, in the way only she could say it. And no, we had.
And you talk about Ethel Merman also having some. She volunteered when she was in New York City at Roosevelt Hospital every week.
Yes, for many years. Yeah. And she used to get all dressed up, and she said, "I'd like to look nice for them." And I never forgot that, because I never went to work in any of Mother's homes looking like a sad sack or a mess. I didn't put on white tie and tails, but I was, you know, it was nice, you know, button-down shirt and chinos or whatever, you know. But they don't need to see some, you know, sad sack coming in there. They have enough trouble.
At what point were the sisters not surprised that you kept coming back? I mean, because at the beginning, I'm like, oh, my God, is he going to get through the first day of all the work that you had to do there? And you obviously did.
Well, you know, I just it was a lot of work, yes, but it was so rewarding, so rewarding. You know, when the first man that Mother took off the streets to the gutters of Calcutta, she carried him in her arms. She was much younger then, and she took the worms out of his body and washed him and fed him and clothed him. And he looked up at her and he said, Mother, why are you doing this? And she said, because I love you. And his last words on this earth were, I've lived my life like an animal, and I'm going to die like a king.
Wow.
And we saw more, you know, everyone died that way, you know, because I say again, the unconditional love. And they were, for the first time, they never had it in their lives. So, you know, it was the blessing was all mine. And I would sit on Mother Teresa's terrace, and I would sing. She'd ask me to sing for her, and I would sing. And then she asked me to sing in an Easter Sunday in the Home for the Dying in Calcutta. And I want you to know, Amy Beth, with 50 dying men on one side, 50 dying women on the other side, and this is the last music they'll ever hear, and Mother came to me afterwards. She said, what a blessing you gave us for Easter. And I was thinking, holy cow, Mother. Only I didn't say holy cow to her, but I thought that. And I said, you know, the blessing was all mine. I got the blessing. With all the work and all that, when you give the love you get back is the blessing, is your blessing. Really, very deep. Very deep.
That's so true. And that's what Mother Teresa was saying, that you have to live for other people. That's the whole point of life. And I think more people understood that. I think more people would be, we'd have obviously a much better world, but also you'd be happier yourself too. It's not as counterintuitive as it may seem in our narcissistic society where everybody's after their own stuff. It's so beautiful the way you tell the story and just the transformation you made. And I know you give credit to your now husband, Jim Russo, who you finally married after 42 years of being together. And all the transitions you've seen in your life, right? I mean, just amazing how as a little boy you had to hide so many things from your family. Even when you were a young man, knowing that you were gay, but going out with all these socialite girls and so forth and not feeling quite right about it and coming to terms with that. I mean, just all the, and now things are much more accepted. Still, people struggle, so I think it's great that you're putting your story out there so people can
relate to it. But it certainly is a different world from 48 years ago when Jimmy and I met, you know. It's a different world, but there still is a lot of prejudice, a lot of young kids who, and even on that level, I hope that some read my book and get something out of that. Well, we were very lucky because our parents ultimately we never shoved anything in their faces, you know. We were just together. And our parents were wonderful about it. My parents, accepted him, invited him for lunch every Saturday and Sunday, and I'd go out to New Jersey to his family. Of course, he always says we were so different. He said I was making œuf à la neige in Monte Carlo with Marlene Dietrich. He was making spaghetti and meatballs with his mother in New Jersey. But we blended. We blended perfectly, and I blended with his family, and he blended with mine, and he blended with all of the people in who had been in my Lee Lehman and Ethel Merman and Mother Teresa. So it couldn't have been more perfect. I mean, I've been so blessed, and we treated these people like human beings. Because you know how hard it is to be an Ethel Merman, to be a Mother Teresa is even worse, to be considered a living saint. But they were human beings, and they trusted us so much. You see, Jimmy's just in my other ear saying, and they trusted us. I mean, we had no agendas with these people except to just, you know, unconditional love flowing back and forth.
Just
so we can
together, right?
Excuse me?
Just having the human experience together. That's it.
Yes,
exactly.
No agendas, no agendas. So we've been very, very, very fortunate. But, you know, my brother doesn't want to hear about it. My brother won't read the book.
Oh, really? Because it's interesting. In the book, you do talk when you were growing up, your brother, who's a couple of years older than you, was kind of bullying and not so nice to you as a kid. But later on, there seemed to be a little reconciliation of sorts where he does say he felt bad that he wasn't as nice to you. And I guess he did find out about what happened with that school teacher. And he said, maybe if I was nicer to you, that wouldn't have happened. So
that's right.
Now you're on the outs again, or he just doesn't want to deal with it?
No, it's just that if any, let's say, successful things that I've done in my life or positive things, I think there's still that jealousy that has lived on from his childhood. And it's his problem. It's his burden, you know.
Oh, sure.
I've forgiven my grandmother. I've forgiven all of those things. And I know that my molester must be dead by now, or he'd be 110 years old. But and someone asked me at in Dallas. I said, "How do you deal with forgiveness?" And I said, "It's their burden to bear. Whatever they did to me is their burden, not mine anymore." And my grandmother was the same. I forget. At the end of her life, she was completely senile, and she didn't even know who I was. And I just turned to my father when we visited her, and I said, I had to go see her one more time. And I found this little senile lady in a bed and singing little children's songs to herself. And I turned to my father and I said, "We can go now." And all of the past was erased. It was her burden to bear. She has to deal with whatever her life was and what she did. But she never broke me. As I say in the book, I had two things. I had great sensitivity, but I also had courage. And I stood up to her. When I stood up to her for the people who could not stand up to her. You know, I would not allow her to bully or be, use her perverse madness against people who couldn't defend themselves. And I, at the age of 6, I'm standing up to this lady everyone was terrified of.
You had a great inner strength as a young child, and the sensitivity. It's an interesting balance that you had, and it certainly blossomed as you got older, and you were fortunate enough to have these people come into your life, and fortunate enough to recognize it. I think that's also part of it, as opposed to just learning to let it slip by. You seize those opportunities and nurture those relationships in a beautiful way. And have lived this remarkable life. I know you were sad towards the end of the book to talk about how you had some physical challenges of your own that forced you out of your volunteer work. How are you doing now?
Well, it's progressive. It's what I inherited from my mother, peripheral neuropathy. I'm very fortunate, but I don't have any pain with it. It's just that the nerves in my legs and my arms are slowly dying. But I still get around. It's limited, but I can get around. And I don't moan and groan about it. It's, you know, no one gets out of this world scot-free.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
It's true. It's true. And then, I saw a kid who didn't look more than 18 who the other day on the street, they were putting him in a car, and they had to carry him. And you could see that he was completely, he was a quadriplegic. And I thought, well, who am I to complain about anything? You know, I'm 73, he's 18, he's in a much worse state than I am and hope ever to be. But, you know, who I make friends with now all the time? There are homeless people on Madison Avenue in New York, and there's this wonderful, wonderful black lady who's completely crippled. She's elderly, and she's crippled, completely crippled. Her name is Musette. And Musette and I have become fast and furious friends, and I always give her a hug when I go by her and we talk. And she's very wise, smart lady. And one day, 2 weeks ago, I was hugging her, and there was a homeless man who was also crippled who came across Madison Avenue to where I was there with the Musette. And you know what he said to me, Amy Beth? He said, "Can I have a hug too?"
Oh, wow.
I mean, that is, I'm probably the only person in New York who goes around giving homeless people hugs, but
good for you. We need more people like you. Wow, that's beautiful.
Well, they call me their angel, and I call them my angels, because they are angels. They really are, because they give you so much more back than you could ever give them. Yeah. But
it's pure human experience. That's what you describe in your book, and just the exchange.
Yeah.
You're not worried about class. You're not worried about money. As you said, you're not worried about any. You have no agenda with anybody. It's just that pure transference of love. So that's beautiful. Tony, really, it's a great book. I hope people get to read it. I know you're touring around with it here and there. People can find more information on your website, tonyquantro.com. The book is called Ethel Merman, Mother Teresa and Me. I recommend it. I don't recommend everything as highly as I recommend this, because it really is a great story, and it's told so well. And,
I love you.
What a great heart you have. And thanks for sharing your story with everybody, and thanks for doing all the great work you've done in your life, and I wish you and Jim the best.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy Beth. And I send you my love, okay? And I'm going to tell Musette all about you today.
Please do. Give her a hug from me. Thank you so much, Tony.
I will.
Take care.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Tony Quantro. Find out more about his book. Really, I do recommend it. It's Ethel Merman, Mother Teresa and Me. TonyQuantro.com is the website. It's the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. You can reach out to us via Twitter at AB Writes, or, of course, on the phone line, 347-857-4505. The show today being brought to you in part by Time Warner Cable Movies on Demand. Watch what you want when you want to watch it. And here is one of Tony's other mothers, Ethel Merman. Everything's coming up roses.
I had a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you. You'll be
Merman, one of Tony Quattro's other mothers on the Amy Beth Arkwright Show with one of her signature songs, Everything's Coming Up Roses, from Gypsy. Really, check out that book. I think you'll enjoy it. Ethel Merman, Mother Teresa, and me. Find out more at TonyQuattro.com. So speaking of memoirs, sometimes it's tough to write. You get your own story, and, you know, you got some hard stuff to get through. There's no question about it. It can be an emotional slog. So hats off to one of our Inspiration to Action Challenge shout-outs today. It is Nikki who says, I'm working on a memoir, dug in with some pretty hard stuff, but the Inspiration to Action Challenge helped me get there. Thank you. Well, thank you, Nikki. Good luck to you. And Paulie who says, writing poems for the first time again in years, you gave me the right nudge in the right direction. So happy to hear it. Hey, if the Inspiration to Action Challenge is helping you, please reach out via the website amybetharkowee.com. Tell us. We'll give you a shout-out. It helps inspire other people as well. And if you need help and you'd like to start the Inspiration to Action Challenge, contact me. I will walk you through the primer. We'll get you going, too. No promises, because it's not a panacea, but if you work it, it may help you. So find out more at the website amybetharkowee.com. At the Twitter feed at AB Writes, Stan says, enjoyed the conversation. I will look for the book. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Amy. Well, thank you, Stan. And we'll take a caller now as well. Hey there. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi there.
The show.
Hi there. Hi there. I think that was a fabulous, fabulous interview. Very enjoyable.
Thank you.
I can't wait to read the book.
Well, I hope you do, because it really is a compelling story and so well told, and I think Tony Quattro is a pretty remarkable man, I have to say.
He certainly sounds it. And I enjoyed his take on Ethel Merman, because I remember her as, when I was growing up, she went to the same beauty parlor that my mother went to. And
oh,
I
really?
Met her. Yeah, I met her on many occasions. She was quite.
How was she?
She was very interesting.
Character?
Oh, she's a real character. But she did a lot of good things. He was right. She did talk about going to the hospital.
Yeah. Apparently
so,
she did. A lot of people do
things that people don't necessarily know about. She did a lot of good things. She just was very, you know, she was very brash to most people. But she, you know, she had a wonderful voice. She never needed a microphone, that's for sure.
That's right.
Yeah. And
yeah,
by the
true.
Way,
right.
How do you like how interesting that Paul Simon was arrested with his wife in New Canaan?
Yes, I heard a little bit about it, although they said disorderly conduct. Do you know anything more about it?
It was a family dispute. They were arrested around 8:20 on Saturday night. They must have spent they were arrested, but they must have spent some time in jail, because they weren't released until 10:30 in the morning this morning. Isn't that interesting? So they said that the investigating officers gathered information and found probable cause to arrest both of them. So they were released around 10:30 a.m., but they were arrested Saturday night.
Now, were they arrested at their house or somebody else's house?
No, their house. They had
their
a house
in Connecticut.
In New Canaan. They were married in 1992. They have three children together, but obviously it was a family dispute. They didn't go into any more than that.
Yeah, I saw a family dispute, but I wasn't sure exactly where it happened, the circumstances. Well, I'm sure more dribs and drabs will come out, but I appreciate your gossip eyes and ears on the.
I thought you mentioned it earlier, so I thought I'd let you know what it was all about. It was disorderly conduct charges for a family dispute.
Yeah, that's what I heard. But
right.
Okay, no more details. We'll get more details as it comes out. I appreciate the call. I hope you enjoy the book. I think you will.
I can't wait to read it. Thanks so much again. Have a great day.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate
You're welcome.
It. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Yeah, there you go. So we got a couple more readers for you, Tony. Ethel Merman, Mother Teresa and Me is the book, and it's fascinating. It really is. And it's got some juicy stuff in there, too. You got society gossip and family history. I mean, he's got everything in there. It really is. It reads like a novel, really. It's a lot of good stuff. So check it out, indeed. 347-857-4505 if you're listening live on Monday, April 28th. And, of course, as we said, it's always 24/7. Something's buzzing on Twitter at AB Writes. We've got some interesting shows coming up as we sashay out of April. Hard to believe. We are. On Friday, we will have, for our May Days show, meet musician Jerry Boudet. He's been kicking around for a while. He makes a very unique sound. He's got some new stuff up his sleeve, and we will hear some of it and talk with him about his inspirations. And coming up for our Mother's Day edition, close to Mother's Day, right? Is that coming up soon? On Friday, May 9th, we're going to talk with Joe Mader, the former rock and roll madam DJ from Miami and New York City. She's got a compelling memoir out called When I Married My Mother. We'll talk with her as well. And with you, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, we're booking, I guess, primarily for June and beyond now, authors and filmmakers, musicians, theater folks, and media mavens, folks who like to sit around and dish hot topics in the news, film, TV, books, that sort of thing. Hop over to the website, amybetharkawi.com. Trudy's got the big book, and we will be in touch and get you into the mix. We like to showcase all kinds of folks emerging and notable voices throughout, the arts and pop culture, personal growth, and justice, like we say. We're covering it all, and we had some justice with Paul Simon. Also, this whole racism thing in media again, you talk about, we were talking about how times change, and then sometimes the underbelly hasn't really caught up with things. Everything comes up, the negative stuff, as you make progress, whether it be gay rights, and then you start having more gay bashing incidents, unfortunately, that occur. Same thing with racism. All these racists are coming out of the woodwork in ways that are very unpleasant and disconcerting. You heard about Cliven Bundy last week. I think we might have touched on it. That rancher out of Nevada who, by the way, is in dispute with the federal government. He hasn't paid his grazing fees. He owes millions of dollars. He's disputing it because he doesn't acknowledge the federal government. So he's a lawbreaker himself. Somehow, during his interviews about this, and he became a Fox News darling for a while, they have since dropped him like a hot potato, because he made some ridiculous racist comments that I'm not even sure how he got into it, but I guess via some interviewer, he started talking about when he goes into Las Vegas and he sees houses with African-American people on the porch, and they're just, in his words, standing around doing nothing because they have nothing to do. Oh, and by the way, maybe they were better off during slavery when they learned how to pick cotton instead of living under government subsidies. That, of course, were the comments that got him, were even too outrageous for Sean Hannity and company. But what strikes me, besides the horrible racist attitude of these comments, clearly, and this notion that anybody would be better off under slavery, is mind-boggling. But this man is a lawbreaker himself. He is someone who is not paying his way. He's not paying his fees, his taxes. So he's talking about other people, regardless of race, class, or anything else, living under subsidies. What is it his business? Why is he even getting involved in that kind of a comment? That makes no sense to me. So, of course, he is now on the outs with the right-wing movement, which embraced him as some kind of a symbol of what? Government overreach, I guess they called it. And there may be some issues there with eminent domain. There are issues that percolate that I'm not saying are all wrong. But if you have to pay fees to use this land, that's the law. If you don't like the law, then you have to find a way to try to change the law. But if you're a lawbreaker, you're a lawbreaker. So I just, I don't know how you make a folk hero out of that. But they tried. Then it came back to bite them. And then, of course, over the weekend, we had this revelation from the guy, Donald Sterling, who owns the L.A. Clippers, some tape that was released by his ex-girlfriend, who I guess is mad at him because his wife is suing her. I mean, this is also a convoluted gossip story like you can't believe. The guy's got to be in his 80s. The girlfriend looks like she's in her 20s or early 30s, so that's already another side issue. But he made some comments about why you're bringing black people to the game. Now, the NBA, first of all, again, I don't get it. I don't understand. I don't really have this kind of sensibility, so I don't understand where these people are coming from. But especially, where are you coming from when you work and you own a team in a league that is about 70, 80 or more percent black players? So I don't understand. I don't get it. And why was this guy, by the way, was going to be honored, apparently, by the L.A. NAACP for some kind of an award, even though he had a long history of making disparaging comments and doing things in his real estate practices where he discriminated against African Americans. I don't get it either. They have since withdrew, taken away the award, which makes sense. But here we go again. We're in 2014 and people are talking. Anybody on this planet, anybody in this country is talking about the possibility that maybe slavery was a good thing. And then with Bundy, when he goes back to his apology was so ridiculous, he said, well, I never said they should be in slavery. I said I wondered if they would, and we should talk about it. Really? Like, this is a question that the country should have a conversation about, maybe slavery was a good thing. Don't get it. And you got to be careful when you make your folk heroes out of nothing and out of people that just come along with crazy ideas. There you go. Just a word of advice for Fox News. They don't listen to me, of course. Not interested in me. But anybody can make a folk hero out of anybody and not know what they really stand for and what they're really all about. So you got to be careful. And again, somebody on Twitter, and this is an interesting point, Murray on Twitter said, wouldn't you rather them be out front about what they think? Something to be said about that, Murray, you're right. I mean, in some ways, you're better off knowing. Now we live in a very PC world where everybody, maybe they're thinking bad thoughts, but they kind of hide it. I don't know which is better. I think you should maybe hide it for a while until you get the right thoughts. can't tell people what to think or feel. You got to respect yourself.
And y'all are some of the sweetest people I know, really. That's all you got to keep doing is feeling good with your music. Get down! If you disrespect everybody that you're running to, how in the world do you expect anybody to respect you? Don't give a damn about the man with a Bible in his hand. Respect yourself. Respect yourself. Respect yourself. If you don't respect yourself, ain't nobody gonna give a good goddamn no. People talk about the president. He won't stop the air pollution. Now listen, put your hand over your mouth when you cough. That'll help the solution. Don't give a damn about the man with the Bible in his hand. Just get out of here and let the gentleman do his thing. Respect yourself. Respect yourself.
And respect yourself, indeed. You do that, and the rest will take care of itself. On the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show at the Twitter feed, Cynthia says, hey, great show. Love the conversation with Tony and your comments on racism. You're right. It's insidious. Indeed, it is. But get out there and you know, unconditional love. I think that it's such a great gift that you can bring to the world, and forgiveness and kindness and trying to find the best in people. I think that's a great gift that Tony inspires us to do. So let's try to do that if we can and make the place a better world. We can do it. We definitely can. But it takes a little concerted effort, and sometimes that's not so easy to do for so many people. But we can do it. I know you can do it. It's like the Inspiration to Action Challenge. If you want to do it, you can get in there. You certainly can. And speaking of doing it, happy birthday to Harper Lee. She's 88 years old. To Kill a Mockingbird, what a big book that was as a kid. So many people. I think it's still required reading. God bless her. She made enough royalties to live off that one book. Still waiting on number two. Talk about a sophomore slump. Well, think about it. If you write your masterpiece right out of the gate, See, I got plenty of time. I got plenty of leeway. I know I have plenty of time. Nobody knows that, but plenty of leeway to go, that's for sure. I'm working on it. I am. Thank you so much for the kind comments. While you're at the website, amybetharkowee.com, you can find out more information about my stories, the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, available for ebook and paperback. And I am working on number 3. It's slow go, but I'm working on it because I get a kick out of your comments. Remembering the great Lady Ella. It was her birthday on Friday. Would have been.
Sad to be told, but practically everything leaves me totally cold. The only exception I know is the case when I'm out on a quiet spree, fighting vainly the old ennui, and I suddenly turn and see your fabulous face. I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some get a kick from cocaine. I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, that would bore me terrifically too. But I get a kick out of you. I get a kick every time I see you're standing there before me. I get a kick, though it's clear to me you obviously don't adore me. I get no kick in a plane, flying too high with some guy in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick out of you. I get a kick every time I see you standing there before me. I get a kick, though it's clear to me you obviously don't adore me. I get no kick in a plane, flying too high with some guy in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick out of you. I get a kick out of you.
In your heart, far more powerful than memory alone.
You talk too much, you worry me to death. You talk too much, you even worry my pet. You just talk too much.
don't know. You talk about people wherever you go. Just talk. Talk too much. You talk about people that you never seen. You talk about people you can make me scream. You just talk.
Too much. Joe Jones and the Amy with Orgwee Show theme song, You Talk Too Much. Also, of course, Lady Ella. Oh, great Ella Fitzgerald, taking a page from the Cole Porter songbook, and I get a kick out of you. Indeed. Great music here on our Monday edition of the show, and some great folks on the Twitter feed today saying hi. Hello, Izzy. Love the show. Thank you so much, Izzy. And enjoy the music, too. All right. Well, we smattered in. We do that for you. I wanted to point out last week, we didn't have a chance, on Easter Sunday of all times, the passing of Reuben Hurricane Carter. You remember him, the boxer turned wrongfully convicted man, spent 19 years in prison for a robbery homicide he did not commit. He was finally exonerated. The movie Hurricane, starring Denzel Washington, displayed all of the efforts to get him out of prison. And before that, there was a classic song from Bob Dylan, remembering Reuben Hurricane Carter, who passed away Easter Sunday at the age of 76. About to go down when a cop put him over to the side of the road. partner, Amy Beth Arthur's show. Hey, thanks for coming out to our hearty TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora, for helping us put together the show in the booth, and ML at headquarters. Special thanks, of course, to Tony Quantro, author of Ethel Merman, Mother Teresa and Me. His memoir is certainly worth the read. Find out more at TonyQuantro.com. And we'll post it up for you, too, on our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Speaking of which, don't forget, if you miss this show or any others, you can always hear them archived at the Blog Talk Radio site. Also download episodes at iTunes, Popnet, and NetNow. And thanks again to Mediabytes for calling the Amy Beth Arquie Show one of the best professional podcasts and empowering, entertaining tour de force. We try to live up to that every day. It's not always easy, but we do what we can, and we thank you for joining us. Hey, have a great week. Whatever you do, wherever you go, drive safe, play nice, dream big, come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arquie Show. Don't forget, it's 24/7 at Twitter, at AB Writes, as we dodge.
Scratchy throat and my eyes all full of tears. I got a